Hi, Eli. Hi, Eli.
Hey, how are you, Bob?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
The Blog Father.
The Blog Father. Now, that's a... I'd take that name.
Yeah.
It's probably already taken. Blogfather.com is probably already taken. So how are you? We haven't done this in a while. Years.
It's 3 years since 2008. We did it before the DNC convention. And, no, I'm doing well.
And then before that, from Iraq...
Yes.
Where you were live and in the field. It was very dramatic. And you turned me over to an actual American military officer.
Yeah, Major Chris Norrie. I remember it well. Mm-hmm. And that was a terrific experience, kind of reporting from the field. I think I was the first overseas Blogging Heads correspondent. Is that right, Bob?
You may have been, certainly from Iraq. I don't know if that was the very first one from overseas. But you also, that was one of the very first reports on the Sunni awakening. I mean, honestly, I think we had the story before the New York Times did because you talked about it. You were just reporting it at that time.
Yeah, I was. And I have to say, the credit in the U.S. press goes to the AP, who had the first interview with the awakening leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we were one of Blogging Heads
in
the New
credit.
York
let's
Sun were one of the first. Yeah, but
let's take credit before
the New York Times.
Yes, for sure. So anyway, now you've got this very interesting piece in the New Republic. I found it truly illuminating. I learned some things I didn't know, and I found some new things to be scared about. It's about the foreign policy views of the Republican presidential candidates. So I wanted to talk about that for a while and then maybe skip around the world and talk about some other stuff.
Sure.
But it was really a good piece, and one of the things I guess I hadn't fully realized, and you spend a fair amount of time on it, is the extent to which Michelle Bachmann seems to have come under the influence of Frank Gaffney.
Well, the Bachmann
You're careful in the way you put it. I know. It's kind of not official, but you have a number of people. You kind of have to dance around it for reasons.
Well, the Bachmann campaign did not cooperate with me for the piece,
right.
So I did put these questions to her staff, and they are her campaign, and they didn't want to participate in it. They were really the only campaign that didn't participate in the piece with me. But I did talk to Frank Gaffney, and I also talked to others kind of around what might be called the anti-Sharia movement. And the great hope would be that Bachmann, who has already expressed support for what's called their Team B2 report on Sharia law in America and the influence of what they consider to be Muslim Brotherhood fronts in the United States on the U.S. and that they would claim it's global war on terrorism, and that Bachmann has certainly issued statements, has said things to more conservative press that have shown that she sort of supports these efforts, but she has not yet made like a major speech about it, a major kind of campaign event.
She kind of blurbed the report, right?
She's blurbed it.
And can you stop and say a little bit about the report? Was this put out by Gaffney's Center for
Security Policy? It's a group of policy intellectuals. It includes Andy McCarthy, who is a former U.S. Attorney who
writes for National Review,
right, and prosecuted the first 1993 World Trade Center bombing case against defense attorney Lynn Stewart, who is now actually in jail for, collaborating with her clients in that. Also, a guy by the name of David Yerushalmi, who was recently profiled by the New York Times, kind of a firebrand activist, and others. James Woolsey is on the report. Mm-hmm.
And the report, I mean, I'm actually interested in how you would characterize the report. I would call it alarmist in the extreme. I mean, they take seriously this possibility, as I understand it, that, you know, that really Sharia law could somehow, like, you know, take over America or something, you know.
I don't know
many people who take that seriously.
I would say that the report focuses on a couple of things. One, it culls from a number of lawsuits and open court documents that show some of the groups that are kind of, I guess, supposed mainstream American Muslim organizations like CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations,
mm-hmm.
Their leadership were involved in, were actually taped in this FBI investigation, which led to the prosecution of a charity known as the Holy Land Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an enormous amount of information in the public docket that suggests, and there is this kind of famous memo that was disclosed, I think, in 2007, by the prosecution, by the government, which is which reads like a conspiracy to take over the United States. It's a
That's all fine, but yeah. Here's what I'm saying is, if you understand like the demographic composition of America, right? You understand that this isn't going to happen. Okay, there's not going to be some insidious, slow, creeping, you know, takeover of America via Sharia, some implementation of Sharia through the courts, right? Because there's just, even if you assumed that every Muslim in America was, like, in on the plot, which would be off by about 100%, there's, like, not enough Muslim judges, right? I mean, this is crazy, Eli, right?
I agree with you that the idea that there is a serious threat to make America an Islamic republic is crazy. I think
that is the, I don't know if they put it quite that way in the report, but they're really trying to stir up the serious fear about this kind of outcome, right? That's the idea behind the report. There's really some
pretty extreme language in it. Well, I think the report gets in trouble in two areas. One area is that it fails to distinguish between a radical interpretation of Sharia, or is just Sharia
mm-hmm.
just means Islamic law, so
right.
the equivalent of saying halakha, which is Jewish law. And, you know, like most law, it's a disputed issue, and you can find some Muslim jurists who completely disagree with Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, and you can find others that are very extreme. And when they in the beginning say that they're interpretations of Sharia, but in the meat of the report, there are sentences that seem to assume that the most radical interpretation of Sharia is in fact the correct one. And in that respect, it makes it, I think, an important categorical error, because it actually kind of concedes a debate within Islam to the likes
right.
of Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
The second area I think that you kind of touched on where it gets into a bit of trouble is that I think it's perfectly fine to limit a critique of Muslim American organizations that are mentioned in, you know, the government's prosecution as unindicted co-conspirators. There's a paper trail there. Some of these organizations are not open about who funds them. There are legitimate journalistic inquiries. But then to assume that these organizations have the power, the numbers, the wherewithal to become
mm-hmm.
a serious kind of political movement that would
mm-hmm.
change, you know, the way that courts are interpreting law, you know, in such a way that, you know, you would somehow see the Constitution itself erode, is to exaggerate to hyperbolic dimensions what it represents. And I think in some ways there are legitimate questions that might apply to the integration of Muslims and the role of political Islam in Europe, but they don't necessarily apply here. So it's been now quite some time since, I think you can credibly say, people who have been inspired by at least the Muslim Brotherhood, if not funded by international organizations connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, for 30 years have tried to establish themselves as the sole voice of the U.S. Muslim community. And so far they have failed because most American Muslims do not believe in what we call political Islam.
You're right, they fail. But my point is that even if they succeeded, this would still be a crazy scare story.
Because
there just aren't enough Muslims.
Not even 1% of the population.
This is crazy. So, I mean, we can talk about the analytical errors of the report, but what's interesting to me about your piece is that it seems to be that Michelle Bachmann has really bought into the worldview of a guy who, I'm sorry, is either cynical in a really nasty, possibly evil way, or out and out crazy.
Okay,
you know,
but if I may,
I want to
push back on one thing.
First, but is there a third category? Is there a third interpretation of Frank Gaffney that I'm missing? Seriously distorted view of the world himself, or is cynically trying to distort the view of others? Is there a third possibility with Frank Gaffney?
I want to push back on one thing, okay? And that
mm-hmm.
is, after 9/11, the FBI and the U.S. government did reach out to the organizations like CARE and other groups as partners to warn against radicalization in local communities, as did many European governments.
Mm-hmm.
So if let's like leave aside the kind of grandiose claims about American way of life and the Constitution, in which we both agree that this report is hyperbolic. But
mm-hmm.
on this one narrow point, which is who is our interlocutor when we try to work with Muslim communities against the radicalization efforts of an Anwar al-Awlaki, who himself, by the way, was deemed this moderate right after 9/11 and actually spoke to Republican members of Congress and dined and had lunch at the Pentagon and was part of a mosque called Dar al-Hijra. And all of these things, like, if you just limit it to this question of, like, who's the right interlocutor, and we shouldn't be working with these folks, we should be working with these folks have major question marks, I think that's a very legitimate line of inquiry, of which, let's leave Gaffney out for a second, but let's talk about a guy named Steve Emerson. A lot of what he said, I think, is borne out to be correct, that some of the groups that presented themselves as moderate were really had a more radical agenda.
Oh, we could have that discussion, but but your piece doesn't talk about Michelle Bachmann and Steve Emerson. It talks about Michelle Bachmann and Frank Gaffney.
Yeah.
And if you ask, you know, why didn't Gaffney confine his report to that question, the question you consider more
because it's not
one interesting thing is that does not have quite the political rhetorical valence of this creeping Sharia idea. Which some of the Republican candidates are getting a lot out of.
Well, before he dropped out, I mean, Tim Pawlenty certainly gave that impression, which was surprising to me. You can find this in Herman Cain's speeches.
Yes, in the most recent debate.
And
Bachmann herself is getting some mileage out of the Sharia stuff, right?
Right. Now, I would say that Rick Perry, you will not hear it, I don't think, and the reason you won't hear it is because Rick Perry has been an open friend of Aga Khan, the head of the Ismaili Muslim community. And I also don't think you would hear it from Mitt Romney, and the reason you won't hear it from Mitt Romney is because Mitt Romney's a Mormon. He understands as a Mormon what it's like to be part of a minority sect that is often attacked, and I think that he's very – I've heard – I couldn't report this, but I've heard that Mitt Romney is very very aware and attuned to making sure that his rhetoric does not attack Islam as a religion, but a segment of what he would call radical Islam, which I think Robert, you and I, and I think liberals would agree, conservatives would agree, there is a sect of Islam which is very dangerous and is at war with the United States. It's not that when you simply modify, you say it's not the entire religion, it's an interpretation of the religion that's a problematic, then I think you're in kind of pretty firm ground.
Sure.
Okay.
Basically, I agree that the problem is the group of people who are interpreting Islam in a way that's inimical to our interests.
But that is the difference between Gaffney and Romney and these others, is that I think Gaffney and I think McCarthy would say that while they have recognized that there are some moderate Muslims that they like, it's almost impossible to be a moderate Muslim that would pass their test. And they really do feel that there's something fundamental about the religion of Islam that makes it at war with the United States.
And that is one of the things I learned from your piece, which I hadn't realized, is that belief leads to a kind of split on the right that I hadn't really appreciated. I mean, I guess I had thought, like, you've got your neocons, and then you've got your extreme neocons, and then you've got your extreme slash crazy cynical whatever neocons, you know, somewhere over in Frank Gaffney territory, so it's kind of a gradation. But the point I see now is that once you get far enough over in Gaffney land, there's really a fundamental kind of dichotomy. There's a split because their view of Islam and Islamic culture is so dim that they don't think there's basically any hope in our sense of the term, kind of, for Islamic societies. In other words, there's no way those societies ever become democracies, so there goes the whole democracy promotion agenda that the more moderate neocons are on board with. So you really have a kind of an opposition here within what maybe used to be thought of as a more unified neocon school, right?
Well, I would just say that I think neoconservatives tend to believe in the prospect of Arab and Muslim democracy, and they support Arab and Muslim Democrats, and that's a kind of key belief that stems from the neoconservative opposition to the Soviet Union, where they believe that you had to support Soviet dissidents and refuseniks, and they kind of apply the same way of viewing the Arab and Islamic world, whereas I think that there is this new view, which is I will call maybe the anti-Sharia crowd, that says it's a fool's errand, it's hopeless, you will never find your moderate democratic Muslims, and so therefore, let's just go with the old model of supporting the strongman. I mean, keep in mind, it was the neoconservatives in the Bush administration that agitated within the administration to get tough on Mubarak, to get tough on the Saudis, to get tough mm-hmm. on, you know, traditional American autocratic clients and allies in the Middle East, and that the Gaffney-McCarthy position would lead to a kind of embrace of a strong man who at least was, you know, nominally pro-American and kept things in line.
And in fact, Michelle Bachmann bought into that line, as you point out, right? That's one of the pieces of evidence that she belongs with that school. She was critical of our dumping Mubarak, right?
Yeah, so in that sense, even though, I mean, actually, Gaffney has his roots in the office of Senator Scoop Jackson, where Richard Perle and Doug Feith and Paul Wolfowitz also worked. You know, so in that respect, I suppose he kind of comes from a neoconservative tradition, but I would say that Gaffney at this point is not really in the neoconservative camp. And there are a lot of people who take this very dim view. Some of them are bloggers, which, you know, I'm sure our viewers have heard of. But there's lots of people who take this very dim view of Islam, and it kind of leads them to, I don't want to quite call it an isolationism, because Gaffney and McCarthy, well, I know that Gaffney supports a very strong and large military budget, but...
And in fact, unless I'm mistaken, his organization gets a fair amount of funding from defense companies, but I may be mistaken.
I don't know that. But certainly, you know, that doesn't lead you to a position where you actually are looking to cut, which is another part of the piece, the military budget. But at the same time, it doesn't lead you to David Petraeus-style counterinsurgency, where you look to protect a population from what you identify as radical insurgents that represent a slim minority of views and not a kind of ideological consensus.
Mm-hmm. What has Michelle Bachmann said about Afghanistan?
Well, Michelle Bachmann, and I didn't include this in the piece, but I've reported that Michelle Bachmann did ask for advice on Afghanistan from Senator McCain. And I'm going to leave it there because I don't know for sure whether she spoke to some other. But she's voted for her vote on Libya went against the interventionists, and her vote on Afghanistan went with the interventionists. So she's supported funding for the war in where some in the Tea Party did not. So she's harder to figure, and I think that, you know, her foreign policy in some ways is not marked by a kind of clear ideological delineation. I think it's in some ways a work in progress, and, you know, she's feeling
things out. But that is two data points on the Arab Spring, that she's against the Libyan intervention and against dumping Mubarak. I mean, it's interesting the way this, you know, this view, taken far enough, winds up leading to a convergence with old-fashioned right-wing realists, right, on some of these issues.
Well, certainly right-wing realists, and we know this, I guess, I mean, if you want to call Frank Wisner a right-wing realist, but we know that the Franklin right-wing realists did not think much of the democratic movement in Egypt and wanted, you know, to hold on to Mubarak. Mm-hmm. And there was certainly a view that that Obama made the same mistake that Carter made by kind of abandoning the Shah by saying that he didn't know if he would allow him to come to the United States for, you know, his cancer surgery and so forth. And this goes back to a classic conservative text by Jean Kirkpatrick called Dictatorships and Double Standards, which, as I remember, we talked about in our first Blogging Heads.
The one that distinguishes between totalitarians and authoritarians?
That's the one, but it also kind of creates this principle that says that Carter wanted to apply the principle of American human rights too universally, and he failed to distinguish between American allies that were important in the fight against communism and the Soviet Union and, you know, just plain old bad Soviet, you know, proxies and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, you know, the argument for keeping Mubarak is the Jean Kirkpatrick one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the difference between realists and the Bachmans of the world is that realists are kind of fundamentally not alarmists by nature. You know, I mean, they're kind of like, hey, we can work with these people, relax. Whereas the Sharia part of the Bachmann rhetoric is highly, highly alarmist and not calm, cool, and collected. You mentioned Perry, and it was interesting what you just said, which is you don't think he'll buy into this sub, because at the time you wrote the piece, he wasn't officially in the race. You talked a little bit about his foreign policy, but it was more along the lines of speculation that he might favor commercial engagement with other countries, you know, over other considerations, which is itself a kind of an anti-neocon position. You know, if engagement with China and Russia is his supreme value, that would give him a different kind of problem with neocons. But in any event, that's kind of all you said. I mean, and you acknowledge that, although as a governor, he certainly favored this kind of international commercial engagement if it would get a factory built in Texas. That's not to say that as president, once he's in a totally different job description, he would hew to that pattern. But this is, it sounds like you've either done more thinking since you wrote the piece about Perry, or maybe picked up a little more data, or you just didn't have room to say everything you thought at the time.
I mean, I was fortunate enough to talk to Dave Carney, who's one of his top political advisors, and a lot of that interview got cut down because, I mean, it was a long piece, and we had to cut it down. But I would just say that on Perry, you know, it's similar in that his Texas is open for business allowed him to, you know, attract investment from Citgo, which is the Venezuelan state oil company, Hugo Chavez, mm-hmm. and Huawei, which is a Chinese telecommunications conglomerate that, you know, is really has been attacked in the last few years by Senator Kyle and other Republicans for being a threat in terms of cyber intelligence, which is to say that it's a little technical, but I feel our viewers can read it. But there's something called supply chain integrity, which is a code for when you use the microchips that are the kind of architecture of our telecommunications networks and our computer networks, that right. it's very easy to place bugs in them that a foreign intelligence service could use and then have access to sensitive communications. And China is probably, along with Russia, the number one or the number two cyber threat to the United States as an intelligence threat. And Huawei is seen as a potentially huge vulnerability in that respect. And there's mm-hmm. a big thing. So Huawei set up its North American headquarters in Texas. Perry was at the ribbon-cutting ceremony. I wrote about this. That was what I wrote about in my piece, and then it was later written about in the Washington Post over the weekend. And so this reminds me of a strain of Republican foreign policy thinking that was popular in the 1990s called USA Engage, and that was a coalition of mainly corporations, but one notable person who was a big champion was Dick Cheney at the time, who was the CEO of Halliburton. And their agenda was stop the sanctions against Iran, stop the sanctions against Cuba, stop the sanctions against all these countries that we deem bad. America's the business of America is business, and you know, more free trade will open these societies up. And of course, Dick Cheney, when he becomes vice president, becomes one of the biggest Iran hawks, you know, in favor of more sanctions and other sorts of measures. So my point was with Perry that just because he welcomed Citgo and Huawei to Texas as governor does not necessarily mean that he's going to be, you know, trade at all costs and anti-sanctions president if he gets to the White House.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would kind of agree. And I would think that maybe a certain amount of the foreign policy positions that he professes during the campaign will have to do with the dynamics of the campaign. And there, I would think that he would be... am I wrong to think he would be naturally drawn in the direction of Bachmann? I mean, let me think this through. I mean, he, for now, although a lot of people are saying Bachmann doesn't have a chance, he and Bachmann are kind of competing for the same niche in the campaign, right? I mean, Romney's going to try to be the moderate. I mean, he and Bachmann are both trying to straddle the evangelical and Tea Party constituencies, right?
Well, I would say, I would say a couple things. First, I think that Perry maybe is trying to combine what Romney's doing and what Bachmann's doing. And let me draw this out for you. What I think Romney's strategy is, it's Mitt Romney's turn. Okay, so you know, and the Republicans, you know, the old line: Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And mm-hmm. usually the guy whose turn it is, like Bob Dole in 1996, he gets the nomination, mm-hmm. and he's the front runner, he's the establishment candidate, and on and on. Okay. However, this is maybe not that year, because you have the rise of the Tea Party, you have a strong movement, popular movement, to voice a more conservative line than Republicans have in the past, certainly compared to George W. Bush, mm-hmm. on Medicare, on immigration. And you have a populist movement right now that wants a more conservative kind of Goldwater candidate. If it's sort of the, you know, be damned, I want the more conservative. And here's the dilemma, which is that almost all conservative, but particularly those activist conservatives that want to see a more activist nominee or conservative nominee, they think that President Obama is the most dangerous president in American history. Mm-hmm. So if you think that Obama is the most dangerous president in American history, then you would want to nominate the person who has the best chance of appealing to the most number of people to defeat him in 2012, and that would augur for Romney. But if you think that the Republican Party needs a jolt, or maybe you think that Obama's not defeatable, you would want to, a sort of standard bearer like Bachman. And I think in Perry, because he's a governor, and because he's got a little bit less rough edges than Bachman, he has more experience, and you know, he used to be a Democrat, the argument could very well be that you know, I am someone who can plausibly beat Obama, but I'm also a true blue conservative in a way that Romney, who's been a flip-flopper, isn't. So I think he's trying to combine the two things of being the front-runner and the plausible guy who can beat Obama with somebody who has true blue evangelical Tea Party anti-tax credentials.
Okay. And does that say anything about what specific foreign policy views he would adopt if that was his strategy?
Well, I mean, I think that it's no, because the party itself is very divided right now. And the one area that we didn't really talk about yet is the issue of the kind of people who want to shrink the debt and to shrink the government.
Right. And that's kind of interesting, because you might think that if Bachman is so skeptical of foreign interventions that were popular in the Bush era on the right, that she would say maybe we don't need to spend as much money on defense. So far, she hasn't said that, right?
Bachman has not said that.
And there would be a temptation to say it, because certainly part of the Tea Party wants to hear it.
Well, more than part of the Tea Party. I mean, Grover Norquist, Al Regnery, I mean, major conservative activists and organizers over the years have said that they would like, in the current budget fight, for defense to be on the table, along with entitlements, and, of course, they're fighting to kind of make sure the taxes are not raised. But they think that defense should be cut as well. And this has provoked a response from people like Bill Kristol and Ed Filner of the Heritage Foundation. And it's a kind of sub rosa internal conservative fight. And, you know, Paul Ryan's budget didn't slash defense, whereas, you know, it's suspected that somebody in the House leadership may have been okay with that. Like, I've heard Eric Cantor, though I haven't confirmed that. So something that the conservatives themselves are sort of fighting out, and it's really the first time since Reagan. I mean, I researched a lot of stuff with Reagan because, like, he's the one iconic figure that every nominee wants to be like. So Reagan's first budget, I don't know if you remember this, Bob, when you were at the New Republic, he gives a speech, he says, listen, I cut all these social programs and everybody's upset about it. The one area I didn't cut, in fact, I raised spending, was defense, because we need, as you know, and it's this classic conservative argument that it's that we're not libertarians because we believe in having a strong defense. There are certain roles for the state, and one of those roles is to defend the country. And in that respect, conservatives and Republicans have not favored defense cuts until now. So that's a huge factor, I think, in secondary questions in some ways about how long and how large a presence you're going to have in Afghanistan or Iraq and so forth. That's a question about how big we want the U.S. military to be, and I don't know where Rick Perry would come down on that.
And by the way, did I correctly infer from what you said that it may be the case that actually Paul Ryan would have been happy to include a lot more in the way of defense?
No, I think Paul Ryan, he kept defense, he held defense at the same kind of...
Right, but I thought you were suggesting that maybe that was under Eric Cantor's influence rather than under
Paul
Ryan's
influence.
No,
I think Eric Cantor might have been in favor, though I don't want to put that on him. It's all the budget negotiations that happened last month with the White House are, you know, kind of based on rumors, and there isn't a lot of solid reporting on it, so I don't want to say that. I mean, I've heard that there was somebody in the House leadership on the Republican side that didn't have a problem with it, and so that Cantor's original budget from the spring, which didn't cut defense, was kind of being, that issue was being reopened over the 10-year budget, and it was being reopened, obviously, with the acquiescence of somebody in the House leadership.
Okay. Yeah, but it will be an interesting question to see how Rick Perry and Bachman wind up playing this, because in jockeying for the support from the Tea Party, this is an easy way for one of them to distinguish themselves from the other, right?
Running for president, why would you want to? I think that question is going to be kind of determined in Congress. I think that it's just a freebie to say, I'm running for president and I think America ought to be strong, because conservatives believe you should, you know, cut Medicare, cut Social Security, you know, but don't cut defense. I mean, that's the...
Yeah, but you just said that there is a lot of the Tea Party that would reward one of these candidates for saying they want to cut defense. But do you think that on balance, that's just clearly self-defeating in the primary, given the overall composition of the voters?
Well, Ron Paul and Huntsman have said that they wanted to cut defense, and I think there's somebody else who's mentioned that they would be open to it. I mean, it's possible that a Tea Party person would reward it, but I mean, it depends on sort of how you look at it. I mean, the other problem with that is that I think Republicans would like to run against Obama as a weak president who did not project strongly American values in the world, and it's mm-hmm. hard to then simultaneously say that you favor defense cuts, because it's a traditional way that Republicans have attacked Democrats, is that they want to cut defense in the way that Democrats have attacked Republicans as people who want to cut, you know, Medicare and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But so therefore, I think it's so easy. When you run for president, you don't actually have you don't have to actually write a law. You don't actually have to pass a budget. You just have to say what you want to do, and that's much easier than actually governing.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that's the place that Perry is going to distinguish himself from Bachman?
I think that for the article I talked about foreign policy and Perry's track record with Dave Carney, who's quoted in the piece, who's one of his advisors. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine, my sense of it is that the argument that Perry would make to voters over him versus Bachman is that, you know, we're both true blue conservatives. We both believe in the vision of smaller government. We both believe in, you know, American capitalism and all these other things that you like. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that I'm actually electable and she isn't.
Mm-hmm. And then Romney, I don't know. I mean, in your piece, you say that Romney is kind of a blank slate on foreign policy, because for one thing, you say his advisors are kind of ideologically diverse. Although I've got to say, when you listed them, it seemed like the majority of them were kind of quite conservative. You had Jim Talent, Dan. Is it
Senor.
How do you pronounce his last name? Senor. I keep wanting to put a tilde over the end and call him Senor. And then a guy named Kofor Black. I don't know how he pronounced
Black,
his first name.
Yeah.
And then I guess you had mentioned one guy who's not so part of the right. But it sounds like, in terms of advisory structure, Romney is not going to be some kind of old-fashioned Republican moderate.
I guess, you know, compared to a liberal, but I think that he is somebody who is comfortable with a diversity of opinions in his inner circle. And he mm-hmm. likes to take the role of a kind of college professor and hear the arguments out. And, you know, he eventually has come down on more hawkish positions that, for lack of a better word, you might identify with neoconservatives. I also think that he's less ideological on foreign policy, and I think he's probably more pragmatic, and he wants to have the maneuverability to take different views. I mean, in his book, No Apologies, Mitt Romney talks about the three great threats to America being radical Islam, expansionist Russia, and the threat of China. And yet...
That's right out of the neocon
playbook. Well, yeah, right. So, I mean, but you can find other moments where, you know, Romney has been more open to on those issues. Mm-hmm. So I think that he's gonna offer a kind of less ideological view on that, and he's certainly not running on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I led the piece talking about Romney's speech from 2007 at the American Enterprise Institute retreat in June of that year, where he talked about how he wanted to, you know, almost have a Marshall Plan for the entire Islamic world. And that's just mm-hmm. something that no candidate and no one could possibly talk about now, given the fiscal restraints of the United States at this moment, and you know, the state of the Arab Spring, and just sort of that idea, I think time is somewhat past.
Okay, well, before we move on to other stuff, is there anything else you want to say about this issue of the Republican candidates and foreign policy?
Well, I think that it's going to be very interesting in the following sense. If I had to bet money, I think that there's a very good chance that Muammar Gaddafi will be killed by the time, or will be out of power entirely by the time, you know, the election really heats up in 2012. So I think a year from now, Gaddafi will be dead. And that will allow Obama to say, at least on foreign policy, national security, that he was able to do what Reagan and George W. Bush could not do, which is to take out Gaddafi, who was the big kind of enemy of Reagan's second term with the line of death. I'm sure you remember all that. And then, of course, bin Laden, who, you know, in many ways defined W's presidency. And so he was able to remove both guys. I think he'll be able to say he was able to do what Reagan and Bush couldn't do. And that is going to be very difficult, because I think what Republicans are going to want to say about Obama is that he apologizes for America on the world stage, that he's somehow embarrassed to be an American. He doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. He doesn't support American allies. He can't distinguish between friends and allies, friends and enemies, and that kind of thing. And all of those themes that Republicans are dying to say, that they say every day on talk radio and Congress and, you know, and publications and so forth, is going to be up against a president who can then turn around and say, well, you know, you guys like to talk about that stuff, but I killed bin Laden. So that'll be a very interesting, I'm just saying, that'll be an interesting dynamic to see how it plays out, because I also think that in some ways Obama himself is uncomfortable, or would be uncomfortable, kind of running on this theme of, like, you know, I'm a badass and I kill American enemies. So it's an interesting you know, that's all.
Although I see two, well, one real sticking point in Gaddafi, and with Gaddafi rhetorically for Obama, and one thing that's not a sticking point but might be in a logical world, and that is that, you know, you said the accusation against Obama is that he can't distinguish friends from enemies, and that this would help him combat that, what he did with Gaddafi. You could argue the opposite, because the fact is Gaddafi had, you know, finally reconciled himself in a basic general way with American interests, right? I mean, he wasn't the same Gaddafi he was during the Reagan administration. He got rid of his nukes. He was disassociating himself from terrorism. So in a way, a Republican could make a realist critique of Obama, and that's in this context, that's particularly true depending on what comes in the aftermath of Gaddafi's death, as you predicted in Libya, and this is the second complication I see, which is that who knows what Libya is going to look like, you know, in the wake of this, right? I mean, it could well be sufficiently chaotic to give people second thoughts about the whole Libyan intervention, in particular if some region of Libya is a good breeding ground for some new branch of al-Qaeda or something. That could wind up, you know, not looking so good.
Well, yes, I think that's the case. I think if that became the case, then the neoconservatives would be, I mean, there's another interesting theme in the piece, which is that, you know, for years, the neoconservatives under the Nixon years were the insurgents within the Republican Party, and the establishment was Henry Kissinger and detente. And even under Reagan, I mean, the neocons were never really like the establishment of the party. And even under Bush, there was always this tension. By the end of George W. Bush, the neoconservatives had become the new establishment of the Republican Party, something that they were not used to, because neoconservatives are very good at kind of raising issues and so forth, but were not good at sort of being the establishment. And I would argue that neoconservatives are kind of the default establishment position today for the Republican Party. If you had a Republican nominee that criticized the Libyan intervention as reckless and enabling, creating kind of al-Qaeda, and using the arguments that many liberals and Democrats used against the Iraq intervention, I think that would be evidence that the neoconservatives have kind of lost their pole position within the Republican Party, and you would see
Michelle Bachmann is already almost making that.
She is almost making that argument, but Michelle Bachmann is not yet the nominee, and Michelle Bachmann certainly is not yet speaking for the establishment foreign policy elite of the Republican Party.
But what she said, things that she says in Get Traction mm-hmm. will influence things that her rivals say during the course of this, I think.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that she seems to be staking out that kind of oddly realist policy on the Arab Spring.
But, I mean, if you think about it, the argument that you just laid out on Libya is an echo of the argument that Democrats would make about Iraq, which is that you paved the way for Iran to influence, you know, events in Iraq, and it's worse than it was under Saddam, which I would disagree with all of that. But the point is that it's a very similar kind of argument. By removing the dictator, you have opened up a space for al-Qaeda to operate in Derna, and that is adding to our insecurity.
Yeah.
Funny how the more things change, right?
Well, you know, these like linear ideological spectrums, you follow them far enough and they become circles, you know.
Yeah.
You also have been writing about Russia.
Yes, for the
right?
Russians.
About how bad Russians are, right? And you got some criticism for this, or you and some other people are making these arguments.
Well, I don't know if I've been reporting. I mean, I've been reporting on something
right.
that I would point
right,
out that
okay.
my critics, you know.
One of whose names is Samuel, is it Charup?
I don't know how to pronounce it.
You don't know. He's not a known entity to you, except that he characterized your work in ways you're not enthusiastic about?
Well, that's to say the least. And I met him once at a party, I think.
And he's at the Center for American Progress. He wrote a piece in Foreign Policy about what he called the reset bashers. That is
yeah.
to say, people that he identified as neocons, basically, people of the Weekly Standard. I don't know if he used the term, but
yeah,
you know
I know what
he meant. Who he said were calling into question the wisdom of Obama's reset policy with Russia by calling attention to a bunch of horrible things that Russia is allegedly doing, notwithstanding our overtures toward them. He says that some of these allegations are kind of trumped up, or at least don't withstand scrutiny. But in any event, you did report
some of the allegations.
Let's
right? leave him out of it, because I mean there's so many errors.
Oh,
well, I mean, there's a lot of errors in it. I mean, but let's just say what I reported first, and has since subsequently been confirmed by the New York Times, is that a Russian military intelligence, or their GRU major named Yevgeny Borisov, is believed by U.S. intelligence, as well as, of course, the Georgian Foreign Ministry, to have ordered a bombing on September 2010 of the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi, and one bomb exploded near the exterior wall, and another bomb was unexploded, was thrown over the wall of the parking lot near the embassy. It prompted a major investigation. The first report that was mainly authored by the CIA concluded that this was an action that was approved by the leadership of the GRU, the military intelligence for the Russians. A subsequent report that came out after my first article, at the request of some senators who cited it, said that there was disagreement as to how high up, whether this was a rogue action or whether this was approved at the highest levels of the Kremlin. And so it was a little bit different in that second report. This has been conflated by a couple bloggers to suggest that my first report was inaccurate, when there are, in fact, two intelligence reports. It's a minor point, but it's an important one. But the bottom line is that it's part of a larger pattern, Bob, that at least on this traditional kind of harassment of U.S. diplomats and other U.S. officials and NGOs like the National Democratic Institute in places like Moscow and Russia's near abroad, the Russian FSB, the successor agency of the KGB, and other elements of the Russian state continue to harass U.S. diplomats, and it's something that hasn't changed despite the reset of U.S.-Russian relations. Now, what that means, or whether you think that's, you know, okay, or I'll take half the loaf, or, you know, everything, that's all fine, and I'm happy for people to debate it. But the facts that I've reported regarding this incident about our embassy in Tbilisi are really not challenged by anyone.
Okay, and I guess one question is, I have not really been following Russia
sure.
that closely. The one reason I bring Charup into this is because he has a larger argument that he's making about reset bashing, which is that, I guess his argument is that granted that we're not getting everything we would like out of the Russians, we're getting a sufficient number of valuable things under the Obama policy that you wouldn't want to jeopardize them by overreacting to some things that you don't like, I don't know, harassing NGOs and stuff like that. I mean, according to him, there's really important logistical stuff in Afghanistan that depends on Russia's acquiescence in our use of their airspace or something like that. There's, you know, nuclear armed stuff and so on. Do you have a position on that? I mean, do you think he's wrong about
that? Well, Obama came into office, and the government of Kyrgyzstan said that they were going to end the lease at the Manas Air Base, which is, of course, crucial for the resupply of the Afghanistan war effort. And then after some hemming and hawing and some diplomacy with the Russians, all of a sudden the Kyrgyz have allowed for the Manas Air Base to be used for that resupply. But there's two things that are kind of elided in Chirap's piece there. One is that it's in Russia's interest to have the United States-led coalition to prevent the Taliban from taking over Afghanistan. They have their own problems with radical jihadis in their own country, and it wasn't really a problem until Obama came into power that the Russian, or in their near abroad, and Kyrgyzstan is an independent country from Russia, but they obviously have a lot of influence there, that this would become an issue. So it's like that's something where he thinks it's a great concession, but I would say it's really the status quo of Bush. And the one thing that I think that he doesn't acknowledge is that the reset has changed Russian behavior in terms of their support for UN sanctions in Iran. Now, they did support UN sanctions against Iran under Bush. They supported again under Obama when they threatened to, you know, try to collapse the sanctions regime against Iran. And the Russians have not been unhelpful when it comes to resolutions on Syria or Libya. And I guess finally there is the New START Treaty, which is a whole kind of separate debate. So there are some tangible things that are a result of the reset. But one thing that has not been touched by the reset is that Russia still occupies the provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which they invaded in 2008 in the war with Georgia. They continue to be a major bully in what's called their near abroad. And internally, the state continues to be more and more power is consolidated along their security services. And the question about the reset is not whether or not there are some tangible results. There's other things that still need work. But the question is, you know, how the U.S. has been very muted in terms of its policy on a lot of those issues, including the human rights question, though it's starting to get better on that, that, you know, that is something that is a tangible difference in U.S. policy. And
it is, but of course you could defend the Obama policy from a realist point of view by saying the tangible fruits that you yourself cited are valuable from the point of view of America's actual national interests, whereas the things that Russia's doing that you're complaining about just really don't directly impinge on American interests in the near term, anyway. Human rights in Russia,
let me counter that, though, because I think that, you know, I've heard that argument. And I would just say this, that, you know, if you have a country that is willing to screw up your threaten to screw up your resupply route into Afghanistan, threaten to sell sophisticated air defense systems to Iran, and threaten to do all kinds of things that would really not be in Russia's self-interest, then the notion that you're kind of calculating, you know, your statecraft with a rational actor maybe doesn't apply. Maybe the way...
I don't think so at all. I mean, I think threats are part of normal bargaining. That's the way it works.
Okay, but what I'm saying is that if you allow Russia to become more powerful with this current security service police state regime, then I think down the line you're just going to open yourself up to being extorted and extorted and extorted. So you're going to continue to pay for things that in an equitable relationship should not be bargaining chips.
Well, I mean, you may be right, but it's in the nature of any relationship where the two parties deem it to be non-zero sum and say, I'll do this for you if you'll do this for me, that both parties, in a sense, become more powerful as a result. I mean, you're ceding assets to them. That's in the nature.
Okay.
If your argument is that making Russia powerful is just this inherently bad thing. Well, then fine, we take it all off the table, declare war. They make it harder for us in Afghanistan. They make it harder for us in Iran, with Iran. And you can do that. But what you're basically arguing is that this just should be defined as a zero-sum relationship, and we should go back to the
Cold War. No.
Okay, that's one view.
I'm not necessarily saying. I'm not saying the indictment
of Obama's policy is that it makes Russia more powerful. Then, no, you really are saying we should not do anything that's good for them. And if we don't do anything that's good for them, they're not going to do anything that's good for us. That's the way the real world
works.
Okay,
but they have not paid a price for invading a sovereign country of Georgia in 2008. They have not paid
a price for the cyber attack they did
against Estonia in 2007. They haven't paid a price for nuclear poisoning of one of their top dissidents.
Do you get the distinction I'm making where I'm saying fundamentally we have a realist foreign policy, at least with respect to Russia, with Obama, and those things did not impinge directly on American interests. And yes, we could have used political capital and even military capital fighting those, but we said we'd rather use them elsewhere and make life easier for our troops in Afghanistan instead, because they're Americans, unlike the people in Georgia.
Okay, so you're arguing that
it is a coherent, realist policy.
Okay, but I guess what I would say, though, is that given the fact that stopping Iran from getting nukes and stopping the Taliban from taking Afghanistan are so clearly in Russia's interest, it's almost like arguing, it's like having a negotiation with your neighbor, okay, over the fence in your lawn. And the neighbor says, listen, if you don't do everything that I tell you to do, then I'm going to burn down my house, which will probably burn down your house. You understand that, like, that kind of behavior, that brinksmanship, where you have somebody who's saying, well, we don't really care if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, when clearly it's, you know, the missiles are closer to Moscow than they are to, you know, Washington. Then when you're paying for the stuff that they're supposed to do, it means that you really are not getting into a situation where you can use your influence on things that matter. And I think that it is in U.S. national interest to have checks on Russian expansion by supporting countries that are democratic like Georgia. Not all the way. I'm not saying that you want to necessarily declare a war, but certainly the failure of the Obama administration to, you know, stop the French from selling advanced naval vessels to Russia in violation of the arms embargo on the conflict, and really failing to sell anything of import to the Georgians in the process, those kinds of policies are an outgrowth of the reset. It's because we're not gonna push those issues.
Your claim that Russia should be doing something about Iranian nukes out of its own self-interest assumes that Russia shares your view of how dangerous Iranian nukes would be. And there are a lot of people who actually don't think that they would be that dangerous. And I would always rather nuclear weapons not spread to another country. I'd rather that we have a non-proliferation regime that works. But I don't think Iran having nuclear weapons would be this super scary thing for anyone, including Israel. I do not think that there's much chance at all that those nukes would ever get used, just the way I don't think there's much chance at all that Israel's nukes would get used or Russia's would get used. So you're attributing to Russia this very dire view of Iran that you may have, but which is in fact not universally shared.
Wow. Well, we really do end on a point of incredible disagreement, and
what makes you think that Iran is more likely to use a nuclear weapon than
think that Iran is run by fanatic terrorists right now who are willing to kill their own citizens in order to stay in power and fix an election, not to mention have used terrorism all over the world for the last 30 years as a way of advancing their statecraft. To give them a nuclear weapon, which would be effectively to empower a regime that practices all of this rogue behavior, including terrorism and other sorts of practices against their own people and abroad, is a disastrous and destabilizing factor for the Middle East and Asia and the whole world.
Well, I'm not in favor of it. I'm just saying that a rational person in the region probably wouldn't be terrified by it.
Well, I guess, I mean, it goes back to, I'd rather
it didn't happen. It increases the risk of bad things happening by some amount. I just think it's a very small amount. And you are of a school of thought, I know, that thinks it's a much larger ratcheting up of risk.
I disagree.
And the idea, you can use all the adjectives you want about the regime, and some of them are justified. But at the end of the day, the question is, do they literally want to die? Okay, that's the question with nuclear deterrence. Do these people in this regime, have you seen signs that they themselves want to die and they want their families to die and all their friends to die? Because if that's the case, then you're right, deterrence won't work.
Well, first of all, they recruit suicide bombers. And they glorify suicide bombers.
Eli, this is just not relevant. I got it. I'm sorry. You can recruit a suicide bomber and deploy a suicide bomber without dying yourself.
Yeah, but it's something.
You can't launch a nuclear weapon against Islamic without dying yourself.
I'm making a point about the culture of the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which is to valorize the idea of martyrdom for this cause and.
Valorize the idea of your whole nation going up in smoke? I haven't seen any signs that they want that.
Bob, slow down a second, okay? I'm saying that this is a country, okay? Most countries, at least most militaries, all right, shudder at the idea of using any kind of terrorism, especially suicide bomber kind of terrorism. But this is a country that has spent millions and millions and, you know, tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to advance this kind of idea and to support this kind of idea and to recruit these kinds of people. And to support organizations that make this a central part of their ideology. Something, a regime like that, even if you don't think it's ever going to use a nuclear weapon, just to have the threat that it could use a nuclear weapon, is far more dangerous than Israel or France or the United Kingdom having a nuclear weapon.
Well, if I don't think the chances of it using a nuclear weapon are any higher than the chances of Israel or Russia using a nuclear weapon, why should I be more terrified?
Because, first of all, once they get the nuclear weapon, they're going to act crazy as if they may do that. And second of all, it's going to give them more ability to do what they're already doing, which is so destabilizing, which is supporting terrorism all over the region.
I don't see how it does that if you realize they're not going to use the nuclear weapon. Do you really think that Israel's policies in response to Iranian-sponsored terrorism or in response to Hezbollah would be any different?
Yes.
If Israel had a nuclear weapon, do you think Israel would cower in fear of Hezbollah?
I think they would be far less inclined to do the kinds of activities that they've done in the last few years in terms of going after senior members of Hezbollah and Hamas throughout the Middle East. I also think that they wouldn't respond in terms of going after
would think that if they assassinated somebody in Gaza, then Iran would not launch a nuclear weapon against Tel Aviv.
I'm telling you that whether or not I can't predict the decision-making process for whether the Iranians would launch a nuke, Bob, but I'm saying that the very fact that it's a possibility that once they have the nuke and they can actually launch it means that they will have you'd have to think twice about the kinds of response you do already to their aggressive sponsorship of terrorism. By the way, the other thing is that this is a regime without a nuclear weapon that threatens to wipe another nation, Israel, completely off the map. Once they do have that, there's a whole argument about what that means
and so on. But Eli, it's a good point. It's a nation without a nuclear weapon that even as we speak, although Israel apparently is assassinating Iran's nuclear scientists in Iran, Iran is choosing not to deploy nearly all the force it has. You haven't seen the barrage of missiles from Hezbollah or something that probably Iran could get if it really wanted. So you're already seeing that Iran does not respond in some crazy irrational way to assassinations by Israel.
Well, first of all, there's plausible deniability, and I'm sure that some of those scientists may be. You know, I mean, who knows?
Oh, everybody knows who's killing
those
scientists.
Well, not every. I'm saying I've heard, but I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of.
Sweden, maybe? Sweden is.
No, I think it's Israel and the United States, but with lots of cutouts. But that's not the point. I'm saying that's in the spy versus spy game. Iran does kind of plenty of things as well.
Israel is now assassinating all the kinds of people that you say they are in fact assassinating.
Well, I think they're definitely assassinating this Makhbouh guy, Eli, you're saying
Israel would have to stop doing all the assassinating because Iran would go nuts. I'm just making the point that Iran is not using all the weapons at its disposal in response to what Israel is doing.
Well, I mean, or you could say that Israel is also doing a pretty good job of trying to foil the kinds of things that Iran does because, as I said, Iran does not use its military the way Iran's military is something like its ability to create and deploy terrorist forces. It uses terrorism the way that other states would use military force as a means of coercion. And that's the key reason, because it uses terrorism in this way is why you don't want it to have a nuclear weapon, which would almost make it much harder. Do you think Iran with a nuclear weapon would use more or less terrorism than it does today? And that's why it's a Iran is a different thing.
I think all the mechanisms for deterring its use of terrorism that are at our disposal and Israel's disposal would still be at our disposal, yeah, because nobody would think for a second that Iran is going to nuke Israel.
Well, I mean, and I would also say that, you know, that as I wrote last year, the policy of sabotage and other sorts of things through cyber and other means to stop the Iranian program, to delay the Iranian program, appears to have delayed it. That's what I would say.
Well, that's true, and that's consistent with what both of us are saying. That's it's true that that's happened.
Right.
And I would reiterate, you know, I'm not in favor of them getting
a bomb. I
just don't think it's worth starting a war over, especially when we have really failed ourselves to pursue a non-proliferation policy that's sufficiently consistent to warrant the respect of the rest of the world.
Okay. Well, I don't think that it is going to be a war. I think that you're going to see more of this, you know, it's like a war in the shadows. You know, it's like a John Le Carre war. There was this fear that, you know, Cheney or Bush, you know, would drop a bomb and it would start another war in this time in Iran. And, I mean, I would just say that even if there was an airstrike against known facilities in Iran, I don't necessarily think that that would start a war. I mean, keep in mind, Saddam was bombed plenty of times by Clinton. It didn't start an all-out war. Instead, I think you're going to see more of this shadow war, where the Iranians do all kinds of nasty things and other people do nasty things to the Iranians. And, whereas I think the real ball to watch would be, the movement that kind of came alive in 2009, because that political contempt at home of so many ex-79 revolutionaries in Iran hopefully will be the most potent force to get rid of the regime, more so than external means.
We will see.
That's a good place to end it, because I would imagine you would agree with me that you do support the Green Movement, right?
I mean, there may be forms of our supporting the Green Movement that are counterproductive.
I would like to see
their vision realized.
I'm not talking about the USA. I'm talking about Bob Wright,
right.
the blog father.
The blog
Does
father.
The blog father
yes,
support the Green
Movement? The Greens will be happy to hear that I'm throwing the support of my entire media enterprise in their direction.
Well, then don't have Flint Leopard back, because he does not support them.
Actually, maybe you should argue with Flint.
I don't
want to
argue
this.
With Flint.
No. You're mischaracterizing his view. I'm sorry. That's not really Flint's argument. Flint's argument is that the Greens do not have sufficiently auspicious chances
right.
of taking over that as a political matter we should bet on them. And it's really unfair to him, I think, to put it the way you put it.
No. I don't, and
he's been kind of smeared that way by people who say, "Oh, you're supporting Ahmadinejad."
Flint
Leverett,
that's
really
Flint
not
Leverett
what he
being
said.
Smeared? That's amazing. Really, you're going to say that? Flint Leverett is the biggest
smear
merchant.
Yeah, I do think he's been unfairly
Pollack,
characterized.
He smears these neocons. He smeared the administration that worked for him. He's a total drama queen, and you know what? I just won't have it. You know what?
Well, say what you will about what he's done to other people. I don't have his whole resume in front of me. But I don't think you characterized his views accurately, and I think it's unfair to try to depict him as some kind of Ahmadinejad supporter. But that's not what he said.
Okay. Well, agree to disagree, Bob.
This has been good and lively.
I feel
right?
It has been good and lively.
We should do this. We should do
I
this
would like
often.
To do it more often. Okay. All
right.
Thank you.
See you around.
Bye-bye.